Amid already simmering tensions in the Middle East, new concerns of a potential Iranian attack on Israel.
We're taking this seriously, and believe me, so are our Israeli counterparts taking it seriously.
Israelis plead for help from the U.S. president in freeing their loved ones being held as hostages in Gaza.
I'm here in front of the U.S. embassy to call upon the nations of the world, and especially President Biden and the Biden administration, to help us.
And outmanned and outgunned, Ukraine fights for survival against Russia's invasion as U.S. congressional approval for military aid for Kyiv remains uncertain. Today is Saturday, April 13th. Join us as we explore the issues in the news. Hi there, I'm Lori London in Washington. Israel is on high alert for a potential attack after Iran's repeated warnings it would retaliate for an airstrike on Tehran's consulate in Damascus, Syria this month that killed senior Iranian commanders. The U.S. and other countries warned citizens against traveling to the region, which is already on edge over the war in Gaza. National Security spokesman John Kirby said the White House is taking the threat seriously.
We're watching this very, very closely. We still deem the potential threat by Iran here to be real, to be viable, certainly a credible.
Kirby reiterated the U.S. commitment to defend Israel, but didn't elaborate.
We believe that it's best for those conversations to happen away from the public eye so that we can make sure, again, Israel is as prepared as possible.
Iran has blamed Israel for an April 1st strike, while Israel has neither confirmed nor denied responsibility. Benny Sabti is an Iran researcher at Tel Aviv University's Institute for National Security Studies. My colleague Michael Lippin asked him how Israelis are reacting.
The people used this spring day and very nice day, and everyone was out, really millions were and are enjoying this beautiful day and going around with markets and everywhere, really, in Jerusalem, in Tel Aviv, and are happy with their time. But they are also very aware about the situation. They are talking about it, they are talking about the news. Those who know me ask me about what is going to happen. I was in two TV shows and I explained that we can be a little bit calmer, but being aware, just because the Iranian regime have the same kind of weapons and ammunition. It's not different from what Hezbollah has or Hamas has. So yeah, the range is different, but it's the same. So we can be a little bit more calm and just follow the instructions, and that's it. So the Israelis, like always, they live in two worlds in the same time. Just a regular Israeli day.
Just another regular day in Israel, but perhaps not so regular because of this heightened threat. And I was wondering, what are your best guesses about what Iran is going to do next here?
It seems that Iran is going to attack with some numbers of drones and some numbers of missiles. We cannot know that until that moment. And also, all this can be canceled because a sudden decision of the leader that we cannot know about that, because it's a dictatorship and that they can call it off in the last moment. So all the signs that also come from Americans are very cooperative with Israel now. All the divisions are put aside. They are putting aside all the differences and all the criticized, and they are supporting Israel and also Europe, Germany, England, France, and all the others.
So do you think this rallying of support for Israel among its Western allies, the U.S., the Europeans, is this having some kind of impact on Iran? Do you think it's making the Islamic Republic think twice about what to do?
It can minimize the reaction. They have to react because they are obligated to it, but it can minimize it. And we heard a few news about a promise from Iran regime that it can be a kind of reaction that Israel can accept and not react to that, because this is the main problem. If Israel reacts to the Iranian reaction, so if the Iranians do the minimum, and Israel can kind of ignore it, ignore the results if some missiles fall in the desert. I don't know. Most of them, actually, they are not so sophisticated. The Iranian ammunition is not sophisticated. Most of them can fall in Iraq, in Jordan, in the middle of their way. And also Israel can neutralize them in the middle of their way with the system of Arrow and Iron Dome. So Israel is not so kind of impotent. I don't know how to call it. So Israel have a lot of capabilities.
So if the Israeli Defense Forces are able to neutralize, as you said, any missiles and rockets that are fired toward Israeli territory, do you think that Israel would be satisfied with that kind of response, just thwarting or blocking any attacks that are underway? Or do you think Israel would feel a need to actually take offensive action as well?
It's a really hard thing to know now, because now as we are talking, there is a meeting of the government and they want to decide about their reaction. Maybe there will be a pressure from US or other Western countries to Israel, toward Israel, not to react if there are not any casualties or any hard damage. So Israel can kind of, how do you say, swallow that and ignore that, and things can go back to that. The Iranians restore their honor and everyone is happy. But really, it's very hard to know it from now. We are in the middle of the minutes, the most important minutes of this day.
Benny Sabti, researcher in the Iran program at Tel Aviv University's Institute for National Security Studies, on the line from Tel Aviv. Thank you very much for speaking with VOA.
Thank you.
Israel said Friday it had opened a new crossing for aid trucks into hard-hit northern Gaza as it ramps up humanitarian deliveries. However, the United Nations says the surge of aid is not being felt in Gaza because of persistent distribution difficulties inside the war-torn territory. Again, National Security Spokesman John Kirby Friday.
Getting trucks in is significant, but more significant and more important is getting the stuff that's in that trucks into the bellies of the people that so desperately needed. And I know there are still challenges on the ground with people moving around.
6 months of fighting in Gaza has led to a deepening humanitarian crisis, with more than a million people on the brink of starvation. But even after the recent deaths of 7 World Central Kitchen staffers, aid workers are still concerned for their safety. UNICEF spokesperson Tess Ingram on Thursday described how a vehicle she was traveling in was hit by live ammunition while waiting to enter northern Gaza to deliver aid.
It was waiting at a holding point just south of the Wadi Gaza checkpoint, where we are often instructed to wait before being called through the checkpoint. We were waiting there as instructed, and gunfire broke out in the vicinity. It seemed to be coming from the direction of the checkpoint towards civilians, who then turned and fled from the checkpoint. Luckily, myself and my colleagues, we were all safe, but this just underscores how dangerous it is for humanitarian aid workers in Gaza at the moment, that incidents like this continue to happen when they absolutely shouldn't.
Meanwhile, in Tel Aviv Friday,
help us! Help us! Biden, help!
Protesters gathered outside the U.S. embassy pleading for President Joe Biden to help secure the release of dozens of hostages still being held by Hamas in Gaza.
We need someone to cut a deal now. We're asking the government of Israel, the government of the U.S., Qatar, Egyptians, anyone in the vicinity, take the stand and bring them home now. Make a deal. We cannot see this prolong anymore.
Despite U.S. calls for a ceasefire, uncertainty over the fate of hostages being held in Gaza, and growing international outrage of the dire humanitarian catastrophe, I asked Elliot Abrams, senior fellow for Middle Eastern Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations in Washington, D.C., if he thinks the conflict has potentially reached an inflection point.
I'm not sure it's at an inflection point, in the sense that the Israelis have from the beginning said the goal is to eliminate Hamas as a military force that can threaten Israel and as the government of Gaza. That requires moving eventually against the Hamas battalions and leadership in Rafah. And I don't think that goal on the part of Israel has changed. nor, I hope, will the United States attempt to prevent that from happening. If those Hamas brigades survive and the leadership survives, then in a sense, Hamas will have won the war. And that is a terrible thing for the United States and for all of our friends in the region. It's a huge victory for radicalism, for extremism, for terrorist groups in league with Iran. On the humanitarian side, more is being done, and there will be still more. I gather, for example, the United States is building a pier that will be able to accept ships coming from Cyprus. There's more coming from Jordan. The Israelis have opened up a new route into northern Gaza, and that's just beginning. And I hope and assume that in the coming days, even not just weeks, days, we'll see more food and medicine, among other things, going into Gaza. There is a stronger effort to prevent the Israelis from winning this war. I think it would be disastrous for the United States, all of our friends in the region, including Israel, if that happens.
What's the end game? What constitutes victory for Israel?
What constitutes victory for Israel is having Hamas in a situation where it cannot govern any part of Gaza, and it cannot constitute a military threat to Israel. If those four brigades, others will tell you there are six brigades in southern Gaza, in Rafah, survive essentially intact with the leadership intact, then Hamas poses a threat to regenerate as a military threat and as the government of Gaza, and that should not be permitted.
Benjamin Netanyahu said that he's also preparing for scenarios in other areas amid obvious concerns that Iran is preparing to strike Israel in response to the killing of senior Iranian commanders. And then we've got tensions between Israel and Lebanon's Hezbollah continuing, as do the attacks by Yemen-based Houthis in the Red Sea. Overall, it would appear the Middle East is in a pretty dire state at the moment.
This is all about Iran. This is all Iran. What gave Hamas the wherewithal to do its attack in October? Iran. What gives the Houthis the ability to attack shipping? Iran. What has built Hezbollah into a fierce military force? Iran. None of this is self-generated. It's all Iran. Its effort to get the United States out of the region to become the dominant power in the Gulf region, and, of course, to destroy Israel. Death to Israel is still their slogan. The question now is, how is Iran going to respond to the recent Israeli attack in Damascus? I do not believe the attack will hit Israel. Iran has generally responded in the way it was hit and through proxies. I think in this case, you will see Iran not directly hit Israel. Either some proxy, not Hezbollah, some other proxy will make an effort to do it, or Iran will try to hit an Israeli target outside of Israel, an embassy, for example. I say that because it seems to me, and has seemed to me since October 7th, that Iran and Hezbollah do not want a direct confrontation with Israel. I mean, that's why Iran always uses proxies. It wants to hide behind them. I think it will either do that or it will attack an Israeli target outside of Israel. But these things have been essentially commensurate with each other. Israel did not attack Iran, so I don't think Iran is going to attack Israel.
The ceasefire hostage release negotiations are on, they're off. We're hearing that Hamas has indicated it's unable to identify and track down 40 Israeli hostages that are needed for this first phase of a ceasefire. Does that likely mean that more hostages may be dead than are publicly known? What can this possibly mean for any sort of ceasefire if they don't have 40 Israeli hostages to release?
These hostages are of a particular type. That is, they wanted people who are sick, women. There may be other hostages who are, for example, male Israeli soldiers who were not supposed to be released in this particular deal. But I do think it's clear that a good number of the hostages are dead. This has been month after month after month. It's reasonable to believe that a good number of them have been abused by Hamas and others murdered by Hamas. So I don't think there's anyone in Israel who believes that they're going, in the end, to get back all of the hostages who are still theoretically in Gaza. I think it's likely that in the end there will be some kind of agreement. But when I say likely, I mean 60-40 likely, not 99%.
How long can this war continue?
I think the war will continue on and off, maybe, until the remaining Hamas forces destroyed, as coherent military forces. I think that if there is a ceasefire and a hostage deal, it's likely that the Israelis will try to go into Rafah after that. And after making the kind of provisions the United States and many others want to see for Gazan civilians who are in the Rafah area, there's a military need for that too, as I understand it. That is, the ability of the IDF to operate in Rafah would be greatly constrained anyway by having so many people from elsewhere in Gaza who are now living there. So it makes sense from that point of view to have many people there go back to their homes in northern Gaza or go to new tent cities or refugee camps or prefab housing that's built elsewhere in Gaza. There's been a little of that, but not as much as Gazans need.
Elliot Abrams, Senior Fellow for Middle Eastern Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations. You're listening to Issues in the News. I'm Lori London. Russia has intensified its air campaign against Ukraine in the last month, hammering its energy infrastructure and urban areas. As Sean Hogan with Reuters tells us, no major city has been harder hit than Kharkiv.
Just 18 miles from the Russian border, a missile can reach the city in under a minute. Western military support has dried up in recent months. A vital US military aid package has been stuck in Congress amid Republican resistance, leaving Kharkiv dangerously unprotected, as Governor Oleh Senihubov explains.
We have a catastrophic shortage of air defense systems, not only in the Kharkiv region, but throughout the entire country, especially in the Kharkiv region.
Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky continues his appeal for more air defense supplies, and this week said almost a quarter of Kharkiv has been destroyed. He's accused Russia of reducing the city to rubble to clear the way for troops to advance. With Russia intensifying aerial assaults on Ukraine's power network in recent weeks, Kharkiv has suffered rolling blackouts lasting up to 12 hours a day. Military analyst Alexander Kovalenko told Reuters it's a possible tactic to scare residents out of the city.
For the moment, Russia does not have the forces and equipment to seize the city. But they can in the medium term. They can terrorize the civilian population, laying the ground for corresponding conditions.
Russia denies targeting civilians and says Ukraine's energy system is a legitimate military target. The Russian Defense Ministry did not immediately respond to a request for comment for this story. But 15 Kharkiv civilians Reuters interviewed said they are determined to stay in their homes despite the attacks. Officials say there are no signs people are abandoning the city.
Sean Hogan with Reuters reporting. Earlier this week, General Christopher Cavoli, the top American general in Europe, gave a stark assessment of what's to come in short order without U.S. military support.
They are now being outshot by the Russian side 5-1. So Russians fire five times as many artillery shells at the Ukrainians than the Ukrainians are able to fire back. That will immediately go to 10-1. In a matter of weeks. We're not talking about months. We're not talking hypothetically.
Speaker Mike Johnson is widely expected to try next week to advance a $60 billion Ukraine package, which remains stalled in the House as members of his own party continue to push back. Joining us to talk about it is James Townsend, Senior Fellow with the Center for New American Security. He is the former Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense for European and NATO Policy. Thank you so much for being with us. How long can Ukraine hold on in this fight without aid from the U.S.?
They can hold up, you know, for a while. They've got, they're using drones instead of artillery. They're using cluster munitions. They're working around to the problem. But the thing is, as each day goes by, it becomes harder and harder to do that. And so not only are the amount of shells that they're using in terms of 155 millimeter shells and also the Soviet caliber of shell, not only are those getting harder and harder for them to acquire, and so the pool of shells that are available getting weaker and weaker, but they're having to use other kinds of ammunition that doesn't do the job as well as the 155 millimeter. And so I know that's a bit in the weeds, but But it just shows that Ukraine is trying all kinds of strategies to buy time until the Americans can get their act together politically and start back up in terms of providing the kinds of ammunition that they really need. Another kind of ammunition they need is the air defense missiles. You know, the Russians right now are really wreaking havoc. They've destroyed a major electrical facility that Ukraine has. It was destroyed. It was using thermal energy to produce electricity, and it was destroyed completely. And so they need Patriot missiles. They need other kinds of missiles that are used to shoot down drones or ballistic missiles or aircraft, whatever it might be. And that's something that they really need. So they can hold out, but it gets harder and harder and harder and harder as the days go by.
When you say hold out, you mean just barely hanging on, though. Can they actually win this war at the rate it's going?
No, they certainly cannot. If the U.S. does not provide any assistance at all, Europe, as hard as they're trying right now, they can't fill the gap. And so I think what General Cavoli said is absolutely right. You lose if the opposition is shooting more shells at you than you're shooting at them. And so that's kind of where things are now. And again, it gets worse by the day. So they're not going to lose today, but in 6 months, in a year, they might be too weak by that time to hold back a Russian offensive.
And then what happens?
Well, then Russia breaks through the Ukraine defenses and they begin to take a lot of Ukraine that they weren't able to do earlier. And the West finds itself in a pickle, because the West has to say, well, what are we going to do? Just let Ukraine be taken by the Russians? We're going to sit back and watch the Russians take advantage of our polarized politics in the United States and Europe's inability to meet the needs themselves. So what will the West do? Ukraine is not in NATO, but at the same time, Ukraine's fight is NATO's fight. And so NATO will be the only thing left between a revitalized, larger, and more battle-hardened Russian army and the rest of Europe. And so this is an acute period now where we've got to turn things around.
And of course, as you mentioned, the power plant, and you know, we don't hear a lot about it, of the suffering. There's a pretty intense humanitarian crisis going on now across the country as well.
There is, and it's just it's the only way to halt that humanitarian catastrophe is to provide air defense so that you don't have this rain of death coming down on the Ukraine people. And so it's just unconscionable to sit back and let the time go by while the Republicans in the House of Representatives are trying to figure out what they want to do. And Donald Trump too, by the way.
There's a lot of concern there too, that what happens in the election in November here in the U.S.
That's right. And that certainly worries the allies. You know that Putin would certainly be very happy if Trump came back. Trump would certainly reduce, if not eliminate, U.S. support for Ukraine, leaving Europe holding the bag and Ukraine being at the mercy of the Russians. So, yes, there's concern in a lot of European capitals, and there's a potential celebration in Moscow if, in fact, Trump comes back.
The Europeans are working very hard to step up their own support for Ukraine, but that isn't enough without the U.S. aid, correct?
That's right. They need a couple more years, frankly, to increase the production of artillery shells and that kind of thing. And so they can't do it in their current state of their defense industry. They're trying, and they're going around and trying to find stocks of ammunition that are in warehouses or whatever that might be available across Europe or globally. The Czechs are being very effective doing that. But in terms of new production, they're not going to be able to be at scale for a couple of years.
Switzerland is hosting a conference or a meeting on Monday to talk about peace. What could that look like without Russia participating? And how can peace really happen if Ukraine wants to continue its sovereignty and Russia wants to take some of it away?
Well, both sides, or at least one of the sides, is going to have to be at a place where they want to begin negotiations. Right now, neither side is there. Neither side wants to begin negotiations. So I think what the Swiss conference is going to be, it's putting ideas on the table about what negotiations could look like, what an end game could look like, what a settlement could look like. I don't think there's going to be anything that comes from this other than an airing of views. But in terms of actually moving forward on some type of agenda to stop the fighting and to find some resolution, the Russians aren't ready for that. Neither is Ukraine.
Jamestown Townsend, Senior Fellow with the Center for New American Security. And that's all the time we have for this week. On behalf of all of us here at VOA, thanks for listening. For more news throughout the week, listen to International Edition Monday through Friday, or visit us anytime at voanews.com. Join us next week for more Issues in the News. Until then, I'm Lori London.